طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Recently, Massachusetts Peace Action, MAPA, presented a webinar featuring Palestinian-Egyptian activist Rami Shaath and his wife, Celine Lebrun Shaath, in a webinar where they tell their story about the persecution they faced for their political activism in promoting the Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in Egypt. It opens with moderator Paul Shannon introducing the webinar and its participants.
But for now, let me introduce our two speakers. Rami Shaath is a prominent Palestinian-Egyptian political activist. He's the son of the former minister of the Palestine Authority, and he's fought for decades in the Egyptian and Palestinian political scenes on human rights causes, of which, of course, there are so many, and so many tragic ones. Celine Lebrun Shaath, his wife, is a community organizer and political activist. She is also a head teaching fellow at Harvard Kennedy School. Now, after their success in organizing a boycott, divestment, and sanctions, as we call BDS, a chapter of that BDS in Cairo, Celine and Rami were targeted by Egypt's government. Celine was deported in the middle of the night, and Rami was kidnapped, disappeared, and spent over 2.5 years in prison without charge. From Paris, Celine organized a worldwide campaign helped out by the Freedom Initiative in Washington, D.C., a worldwide campaign for Rami's freedom. The campaign reached even the president of Macron of France, was supported by hundreds of lawmakers from around the world, and featured dozens of celebrities and public figures, ultimately culminating in Rami's release and deportation to France. So we're talking about a story tonight where something came out of all the efforts of a lot of people, and it's only because of that that we have both Celine and Rami with us this evening. Rami and Celine tonight will discuss the situation for human rights and political activism in Egypt, particularly the shared struggles of the Palestinian and Egyptian people in demanding justice for human rights violations supported by the United States, supported by regimes supported by the United States. So welcome, Celine and Rami. Thank you for being with us, and we look forward to hearing your insights and having the chance to ask you our questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul, for having us, and I'm honored to be with you, and I'm very interested in your forum and the work that you do. I am an Egyptian Palestinian, born to a Palestinian father and an Egyptian mom, born in Lebanon in the early 70s. So I lived through a lot of the civil war and the Israeli bombardment of Lebanon. And the family left Lebanon late 70s before the actual invasion in 82. We went to Cairo. I think this period that I have seen in it a lot of violence, a lot of blood, but also seen a lot of heroism and resistance. And I think that shaped me personally for a very long time. I remember going back to Cairo. Maybe one of my first experiences was in school, making at 11 years old, doing my school talk, political talk once a week, that was usually about Palestine or about the war in Lebanon or about sometimes local Egyptian things. And one day I've been summoned by the head teacher who introduced me to a colonel in state security, who told me that I was not allowed anymore to do my weekly talk. That was my first encounter with Egyptian security. I think at that point, I did not know what state security means. And I wasn't sure why I was banned. But I understood that my ability to express pain or experience, especially when it is regarding Palestine, is prohibited, and that should not be allowed. Again, I've been arrested a couple of times after that during the Iraqi war in 1990, in demonstrations, but all were short times. 2011 probably have changed the situation in Egypt a lot. I was part of the group that organized and managed the square in Tahrir in the 25th of January 2011 revolution. And since the coup in June 2013, things have become very bloody in Egypt. The regime probably who have heard people chanting for freedom, justice, and social justice have understood it in a different way, have understood that this revolution was done by activists, so he should completely put them in jail. That was done by the Islamic movement. He should destroy it and kill everybody. It was done through intellectuals talking and mingling in downtown bookshops and coffee shops, so he shut them down. That was organized through Facebook, so Facebook became monitored. I actually, eventually, when I went to jail, I found hundreds of Egyptians that were arrested basically because an officer stopped them, confiscated their phone and checked their Facebook account. And if he found a joke or a post or even sometimes a liking to a joke or a post, was enough for them to be arrested and thrown in jail as terrorists. Things starting from 2013 started getting bloodier. And definitely the issue of Palestine as well became more and more sensitive. He knew that his positioning regionally with Israel, that is the way to get the world acceptance of his coup and acceptance of the military regime, that has to be done through Israel. And even at the early points when the Obama administration stopped military aid to Egypt, actually it was Ehud Barak and a group from the Israeli Knesset that went to the U.S. to pressure the return of the military aid to Egypt. He knew that that positioning will allow him to go by suppressing Egyptians in every way. But two, also Palestine for him was a problem because the 2011 revolution had a lot of Palestinian flags, had a lot of Palestinian songs, had a lot of Palestinian poems. Part of it because Palestine in Egyptian imagination is the call for freedom, and it's the meaning of freedom, and the struggle for Palestine represent this idea of fighting injustice. And he definitely wanted to suppress those feelings from being imported back to Egypt and building up a new revolution against his corruption and his suppression. By 2014, the Egyptian revolution has been hampered to a very strong extent. And the war in Gaza was raging again with another Israeli massacre in Gaza, that pushed us to reform BDS in Egypt. Egypt had, of course, a long history of boycott programs against Israel, but has never been effective and has always been a rhetoric rather than a planned, organized action. BDS, when it started in Egypt 2014, it started with 10 Egyptian political parties, many NGOs and many syndicates, labor and medical and engineering syndicates. It formed a threat to the regime, not only because it's exposing its regional alliances, but also because in actually most of the cases when we looked into Israeli-Egyptian relations and economic relations and deals, whether in gas and oil or in other economic sectors, it was all run by members of the military regime or members of his security apparatus. So it was the same perpetrators of corruption and oppression in Egypt were the same culprits and partners of the Israelis in different way. And by exposing those relations, it was not only boycotting Israel in that sense, but also exposing corruption in Egypt in many different senses. The BDS grew in Egypt to the point where we were having hundreds of volunteers every month, including many people who were not politicized but were interested in the Palestinian cause. And at the time, the civic space in Egypt was closing, and political parties were not allowed to function. NGOs were closing down, and people were sent to jails. BDS also played a place of where political parties can meet, where can they discuss, where they can unify, at least on the call for Palestine, but also to discuss other matters of the country. By the late 2018, there was the Donald Trump-Kushner deal of the century. And it was very difficult not to engage against that steal of the century. We started organizing around it and being very vocal against it. And on the 25th of June 2019, there was the Manama conference, which was the economic aspect of the deal of the century. We had a counter conference in Lebanon with many of different Arab opposition groups, the Emirati opposition, the Bahraini opposition, and the Moroccan opposition, with the Egyptian opposition and other kind of oppositions in the Arab world. Sure enough, a few days later, I came to Cairo and I was arrested. They attacked my home by midnight with tens of armed men, of course, not identifying themselves and not showing any warrant. They stole basically everything from around the house that was not registered and was not illegal in the legal framework. They told me from the first minute that the guy who arrested me was a general in state security. And he told me, well, I have no idea. This is way bigger than me. And in Egyptian terms, that refers to the presidency office. They took Celine, deported her immediately, unjustly and without any basis of the law. And they took me, blindfolded me, handcuffed me, and threw me in forced disappearance. And in forced disappearance, i.e. a place that is illegal, that is not known, that my family, my lawyers would not know where I am. And I was attached, handcuffed to a wall and left there for a few days. I was not even asked a question, and I was wondering, why are they here? I knew to extent that I'm always been an activist and an opposition, but why now? And why this? Anyway, a few days later, they took me to a prosecutor's office, a security prosecutor's office, which is basically a security officer in the in a suit of a prosecutor's office. where he interrogated me. And actually, that is the only interrogation I had through the 2.5 years of my imprisonment. That was supposedly I was imprisonments under detention for interrogation. I was interrogated once. And that interrogation, he asked me about my opinion in the revolution and BDS and who did I vote for presidency. And I asked, so how is that to do with any case or any charges against me? He said, okay, we're charging you of being part of a terrorist organization. I said, okay, what is the terrorist organization? He said, we cannot tell you. So I laughed. I mean, how can you tell me the organization that I'm part of? And then he said, and we're charging you of spreading lies and rumors against the state using social media networks. And I laughed again. And I said, I'm a very well-known activist. And actually, people make fun of me because I don't use social media. I don't even have a Facebook account. He said, where do you talk politics? How do people listen to you? I said, I get interviewed a lot on TV. He said, okay, so we'll change it. We'll make it TV. I said, okay. And that was it. And from that, they renewed my detention 45 days after the other for 2.5 years. The second day after that interrogation, they took me back to forced disappearance. In that forced disappearance, the guy coming in, again, I was blindfolded and handcuffed, and asked me, what was your number? I said, I don't know. Nobody gave me a number. He said, but you were here in the last few days. You should know your number. I said, nobody gave me a number. So he went and asked and came back and said, okay, you are the non-numbered guy. Of course, when I actually went to prison and met hundreds of other political prisoners and detainees, I discovered that, yes, through forced disappearances that nearly everybody go through, people get blindfolded, handcuffed, and attached to a wall and are given numbers. And they stay like that for days, weeks, sometimes months, sometimes years. I've known of people who've been there for years. Some of them, of course, get killed and buried without anybody announcing it. And this is the places where people have systematic torture every night from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. There is a torture party in every state security office in Egypt where there's people who are forcefully disappeared, where people usually asked two things. One, give us names if you were arrested in a demonstration. So give us names of other people to arrest. Or if you're arrested through a Facebook group, give us names of people in that group. And to my surprise, a lot of the people were asked, just tell us something wrong you did. They don't actually have anything on them on the file, and they don't have any clear accusation. So tell us something wrong that you did. Eventually, they took me to a prison. That prison was Torah prison, which is a complex of 9 prisons. Each prison of those have 4 annexes. So in my annex was like 420 people. In estimates, there is 60,000 Egyptian political prisoners in Egypt, a number that have never been seen. And of course, a number that is very difficult to verify because those 60,000 basically are the ones who are in official jails, not including the one who are disappeared. That jail was basically cells of 23 square meters that we were 18 to 32 people in a place of around 240 square foot, like a small living room. At points, we had this space each to sleep in because to fit on that amount of people. In my case, and many times I couldn't sleep. I had to wait till the morning when people wake up to take my turn. Of course, we're sleeping on the floor in a small mattress with the place run down and packed with insects, with a bathroom a meter by 75 square centimeter, a hole and a cold shower on top of it. And that's where we lived for 2.5 years. I could go on with the unhuman treatments and the amount of aggressiveness and brutality I've seen around me, and I've seen the torture on people's bodies as well as on their souls. With absolutely no medical care, we had a usual people dying because of medical negligence or because of bad treatment. I can tell you a lot about the families who, the humiliation that they passed through waiting for hours to see their loved ones. It's a systematic torture place. It's a systematic detention camp for political prisoners. That is also not only run by oppression, but also run by corruption. It's a full corruption scheme that starts from entering your home and stealing your belongings, going through the money they take from you and from the family for visiting you or for delivering food to you in one way or another, till the money they make through courts, till officially freezing your assets or confiscating them even without a court order. It's a major corruption scam. I can go on about solitary confinements where people used to spend days in a meter by meter and a half room with no windows, no doors, and no lights, and a bottle of water and a bucket for a bathroom, and they should stay there for 2 weeks for the lamest reasons. I have seen a friend of mine dying in one of those because he couldn't take the darkness and the solitary for more than 3 days. It was a very very difficult experience. By the end of the 2.5 years, of course, meanwhile, Celine, my wife, was campaigning outside for my release. Definitely, her campaigning was getting me a little bit of security inside, i.e. because my name was known. I was less tortured and less abused in compared to other people. But eventually led to my freedom. By the end of it, again, I was kidnapped from prison by this time the Egyptian General Intelligence Service, who took me to one of their dungeons underground and blindfolded me, handcuffed me, and threw me there for a few days before taking me to an aeroplane in my jail clothes after stripping me from my nationality, my Egyptian nationality. And that what eventually led me to France. Of course, all through that period, I was not asked a question. I was not interrogated, even in my forced disappearances. But in the first month, when people and a lot of dignitaries asked about my arrest and tried to pressure my release, they were told his arrest is an Egyptian-Israeli-Emirati decision, with a green light from the Trump administration, i.e. forget it, he's not going out. We have the regional backing and the international cover to keep him indefinitely. Well, thousands, many other Egyptians are there for much lamer reasons, but at least in my case, I knew the perpetrators. Yes, I understand I'm... you know, being an activist, and especially for Palestine, people cease to understand the complexity of the whole region. This region has been managed for the last 70 years, at least, with this duality of occupation and dictatorship. They feed each other, they support each other, they coordinate with each other, and they realize that this is the way to pass by with the American support and with the European support and complicity is by having relation with occupation. And the Sisi regime have realized that very early on and has positioned himself as a strong ally to Israel. And that saved him a lot of a lot of the problems he should have faced for his major human rights abuses. Well, I just wanted to make short that last experience, and then we can start talking about the more intricate issues of the Middle East. I'll pass to Celine, maybe her other perspective as my campaigner and support from the outside.
Hello, everyone. I want to make sure so we get time for Q&As. So I'm also more than happy to if we want to get some questions and then to answer. But very briefly, first, I'm very happy that Rami is with me on this call right now, and to have been able to accompany him every time he shares his story. And that's something he's been adamant to do for the past 9 months since he's been out, because we have still so many of our friends in prison. And I think it's an important message also for people to hear. My journey, my journey started through Palestine and led me to Egypt. And I got to see how both are very, both the path of both countries are very like connected, interconnected. I first got to learn about Palestine during the 2008 Israeli attack on Gaza, the very first bombings. I was at university at that time. And 6 months later, I was traveling to Palestine to see on the ground what was happening there. And that led me to, that changed my life, that led me to become an activist and an organizer within the BDS movement. And I remember in December 2009, so actually 1 year after the Gaslit operation, there was this international, I think it was called the Gaza Freedom March, that was a delegation of 1,500 activists from all around the world. And there was actually a big delegation from the US. I don't know, maybe some of you here were there. And we wanted to go to Gaza 1 year after the attack to commemorate the attack and spent the new year with the Gaza people. And so I remember we landed in Cairo, and in Cairo we discovered that the Egyptian authorities would not let us go to Gaza. And for me, it was such a surprise and a shock. How come? And for 2 weeks we tried, and I remember the French delegation ended up sleeping on the sidewalk in front of the French embassy to try to pressure the French embassy, to pressure the Egyptian authorities to let us go to Gaza. And except giving me a very bad image of Egypt at the time, that hopefully was corrected years later with the Egyptian revolution, I mean, it became very clear for me, this complicity between the Israeli occupation on one hand and the authoritarian regime on the other hand. And we can see another manifestation of this through the blockus that's on Gaza since 2006. And it's only 3 years later that I was able to go for the first time to Gaza through Egypt. And it was only because in those 3 years, something had happened, the Egyptian revolution. And as imperfect as it was, it had led to a democratically elected government for the first time with Mohamed Morsi, even though obviously we might disagree with the political tendency. But we were allowed then during the attack of 2012 on Gaza to go. And again, 2 years later, during the 2014 Israeli attack on Gaza, a similar convoy was banned. And because between then, there had been a coup that led to General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi being elected or being in control, being ruling Egypt. And so that shows how really the solidarity with Palestine and like the freedom for Palestine and the freedom of the Egyptian people, and human rights in the region are interconnected. And I met in this convoy Rami, so that was the only good thing of this convoy. I was actually, I knew that most probably we wouldn't be allowed in Gaza. So I thought, okay, there is going to be 500 activists stuck for hours in buses with no other thing to do than to listen to what we might have to say. So let's tell them about BDS. And so printed some flyers and went into those buses and spoke with both with the people about BDS, met Rami, and that's how it started. And yeah, today a lot of the political prisoners who have been detained are like at the forefront of solidarity with Palestine, with many, many causes around the world. And so it's very important that we show solidarity with them in this moment. And especially we're at a time where Egypt is being given opportunity to greenwash its crime. In less than 2 months, there is going to be the COP27 that will be hosted in Egypt. Actually, next year, it's going to be the UAE. So we're seeing regimes with very, very bad records on human rights being granted the hosting of such an event. And I mean, we need to ask, like, how can there be any climate justice in a country where there is no justice at all? So anyway, I'm more than happy to engage and to share more about the campaign for the release of Rami. And to hear from you.
Well, thank you so much, Celine. Thank you, Rami. That's quite an ordeal. And to think that so many thousands and thousands of others are going through it right at this minute is.
Definitely, when I came to prison, there was probably four annexes. Two of them were the Islamic movement, and one was the civil movement, and one was a mixed annex. But in time, things have changed, and more arbitrary people are the ones thrown in jail. And I could not begin tell you the kind of stories I found there. I had with me a doctor, a surgeon, who was imprisoned because his 9 years old boy in third grade was in his lunch break in school singing a song called Ya Hilwa Ya Balaha Ya Ma'a. And that's a very old Egyptian song. And Balaha is a date. And the Egyptian opposition makes fun of General Sisi calling him a date, that he looks like a date. So the school teacher called state security. And they came and found the kid, 9 years old boy. So they arrested his father. And his father was stayed in prison for 2 years, going each time to a court in the name of his 9 years old boy to answer for the song the boy was singing in class. I can go on for hours telling you about this kind of crazy stories of people in detention.
And the only countries that receive more military aid from the United States than Egypt are Ukraine and Israel.
That's true. You can track the record.
It's amazing.
I want to tell you on the military issue. One day when Celine was campaigning and she was and Macron said my name in a conference with Sisi that I should be released. Second day they came and attacked my room and destroyed everything in it. As a punishment for me for having an international support. But 2 weeks later, the officers called me in and said, Rami, do you really believe that the West cares about human rights? This is all bull. And I said, well, if you telling me that governments care about their interests, economic and strategic, more than human rights, you're probably right. But lots of sectors of the Western community do believe in human rights, and we have shared values with them. And in a democracy, those can pressure their governments to change attitude. So he looked at me and said, well, you might be right, but nothing our president cannot change with a good big arm deal. So even a small officer of security in a prison realizes that his president uses arm deals as a way to whitewash his crimes and to give him cover and immunity from the kind of crimes he's doing against his people.
Yeah. Well, I want to open it up to see if at this stage people have questions. If they do, you can go down to the reactions button and raise your hand there. And when we see the hands raised, we'll unmute you. As we're waiting for that to happen, I'm just wondering if we could get into your take right now, both of you, on the situation in Palestine and the situation in Egypt in terms of possibilities for change and possibilities for international solidarity, and basically to find out from you the things you think we should know about kind of the inside story of what's happening in Palestine now, and whether there's anything that that people in the United States can do on the Egypt situation.
Okay, Palestine, we are in a very bad internal situation with a very weak government that was basically came to power after the assassination of Yasser Arafat and his death, and an Israeli occupation of the West Bank that got this government into power. And unfortunately, this government has been showing complete helplessness, inability to engage, and a continued diffraction within the Palestinian political society, not actually the society. The Palestinian society is not fractured, but its political segments are. And of course, in that context, that gives a lot of part of the world an easy whitewash that we don't care about what's happening in Palestine, and that they should shape up, not realizing that Israel is the main perpetrator of even that split in Palestine, and it's keeping it because of its own reasons. Of course, we all know the continuation of settlements, the enlargement of settlements, eating up the land, ending up the possibility of a two-state solution without really any possibility of a one-state apartheid system. We all know the Israeli continued control of water, airspace, and borders that suffocating Palestinians' ability to grow. We all know the situation in Palestinian cities being sieged by the wall, destroying agriculture and destroying development in Palestine. So yes, the whole idea is to kill Palestinian ability to develop and to continue in the West Bank, while pressuring Gaza into submission, on the other hand. Unfortunately, this has been supported by Arab dictators around us. On the other hand, one hand in Gaza, it's an Egyptian-Israeli siege to Gaza. And on the other is a Jordanian silency and a Gulf whitewashing and Abraham Accords that is cementing this relation between dictatorship and occupation. And yes, we have a lot to do. It's actually the United States that is doing that. It is the United States support, funding, pressuring Arab countries into relation with Israel, pressuring the Sudanese and the Moroccans into Abraham Accords. And with absolutely disregard of the bigger and the longer picture. Since I came to the United States, I have been told many times, whispering in my ears, Rami, you have to realize that the United States is going into the Cold War mood. And the whole Ukrainian situation is getting the United States into the very old territory. And I always replied, and who told you that the United States was successful in the old Cold War in the Middle East. The Middle East was a disaster. Half of it was pro-Soviet Union and the rest was in shackles. And if you're going to repeat the same duality in trying to manage the Middle East, it's actually going to blow up in a much worse situation. And that will be the entry, actually, of the Chinese and the Russians. The kind of model that Sisi represents and the kind of model that Bin Salman represent, and the kind of model that Bin Zayed represent, and the kind of model that the Israeli government represent is actually much closer to the model of the Chinese and the Russians, not the model of a democracy, if you're trying to say that this is a democratic value system versus other systems. In reality, it's complicity with occupation, complicity with dictatorship, and that's destroying our area.
So where do either of you see hope, either in Palestine, in Egypt, or in other areas of the Middle East to break open this structure?
I mean, I personally see hope everywhere. And I know it might be like hard sometimes, but like, even like in the campaign for Rami, when I had all the reason to be desperate, the solidarity and the support I found, and sometimes in places I was not expecting, honestly, was very hopeful. I went and knocked at the doors of many lawmakers, for example, in France, but even here in the US, I walked the corridors of the Senate and the Congress, and I received a warm welcome. And yes, BDS is not the best talking point. And so telling them to please act for the release of a BDS activist jailed in Egypt was challenging, but I found support. I found people who were willing to take on this fight. And I don't think that this would have been even possible maybe 1 or 2 decades ago. So the narrative is changing. We see more and more people speaking up on behalf of Palestine. And I think it came very, very obvious last summer around the events happening at Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. And so it's a real source of hope. We met her last week, but like someone like Rashida Tlaib, Ilan Omar, and like women representatives with those positions in Congress shows that. And in France, I would say it's a bit similar, even though it's sometimes more gloomy, but we are winning. And I know there is a question in the chat about, for example, laws trying to repress and target BDS activists, like, and to criminalize BDS. But these attempts have been defeated. For example, I think it was a year ago, the European Court attacked or like criticized France and dismissed like France rulings that had been happening in France repressing BDS as being like a violation of human rights, of the right, the freedom of speech. And so this was a big victory. And so, yes, there are attempts to censor us, to silence us, but we are winning. Rami is an example of that, that when we come together, when we fight, we can win.
Let me add a little bit different angle. I have, since I came out of prison, toured a lot in Europe and now in the United States, and I've seen most of the foreign ministries of Europe, as well as the State Department in here. And I have been in that business for some 35 years. I am astonished that nobody have a real clue of how to deal with the Middle East. There is no plan, there is no strategy, there is no vision. And everybody I met realizes that their policy towards the Middle East is a failing one, but don't know how to handle it. And I think that gives us a space for the first time to create a different narrative, to talk a different vision for the area. You know, mostly when you meet politicians in the West, they have a clear idea, and your ability diplomatically or through activism to change things are very minor and on the surface of the things. But today people are listening, and listening because they don't have a vision. I think in the last 20 years or the last 15 years, all American policymakers have made a clear decision to withdraw from the Middle East. That the Middle East became too expensive, too inappropriate, and is even less strategically important with American independency and having enough oil and gas and actually exporting them. So it became much less important strategically to the United States. Obama have tried handing over the area to the Turks under the Islamic movement in the Arab world, hoping that the Turks will manage the area during American fight with the Russians and the Chinese and the whole superpower quarrels. That failed. And came Trump with the deal of the century, thinking he can hand over the area to the Israelis and they will manage the area till the Americans end their quarrels strategically with the Russians and the Chinese. And I think that failed. And I think nobody today have a vision of how to deal with the Middle East. And that allows us a new space to create a new narrative.
We have to leave it there. You've been listening to Rami Shaath and Celine Lebrun Shaath speaking on a webinar sponsored by Massachusetts Peace Action. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.